Hi, and welcome to the Wonderful World of Disney Villains podcast. I'm your host, Katie, ready to talk about everything Disney. Happy Halloween, everyone. I'm very excited for this episode. For those who don't know, my all-time favorite Disney movie is the 1992 animated Aladdin. And about a month ago, I actually got to meet some of the voice actors from said movie. And in particular, I got to meet the lovely Jonathan Freeman, aka Jafar. And literally, the best thing happened. So I met him, we were talking about Disney villains and queer coding and all of these great things. I told him about the podcast, and he offered to be a guest on this podcast. Let me repeat that. He offered. I didn't even have to ask. It was like the best feeling ever. So fast forward to this episode. We have 3 hours of recorded conversations giving you all the behind the scenes, well, giving you and me all the behind the scenes of recording the animated movie, performing the Aladdin Broadway musical, because Jonathan Freeman is a talented man who played Jafar not only behind the mic, but also live on stage. The Aladdin Broadway musical will be the next episode, so it won't be mentioned that much in this episode. So stay tuned and listen to the iconic Disney villain share his story on Halloween. You know, 'tis the season and all that. Let's go!
When we met a month ago, you mentioned and agreed that Disney villains often are relatable. We talked about Disney villains being specifically relatable to marginalized populations. Specifically, we talked about Disney villains being queer-coded. And for listeners, queer-coding means a character is not explicitly said to be queer, but there is enough subtext for an audience member to read the character as being queer. I was surprised personally, yet also not that you were so on board with talking about this topic, because hello, you've been a Disney villain for 30 plus years. But is this something you were aware of before you auditioned for the role of Jafar? Or was this something that you discovered being a Disney villain for the past 30 years?
It is not something that I was aware of or thought about before when I was getting ready to audition for the character. And no, I never thought about it before, except that in retrospect, thinking back about it, I think, well, you know, as a gay kid growing up in suburban Cleveland, Ohio, kind of, you know, very nice place to grow up, but not particularly exciting, I was attracted to those characters. I was always attracted to those characters. I remember one Halloween, I wanted to be Captain Hook or something, and others said, why don't you be Peter Pan? He's a nicer character or something like that. So I was Peter Pan one year, and I have this picture of me and my Peter, looking so uncomfortable in my Peter Pan, talking to a pumpkin ghost in the front yard. My father made like a ghost and we put a pumpkin head on it. And I'm like standing next to it. It's so ridiculous. Anyway, so no, the short answer is no, I never thought about it and personally, and I never thought about it going into it. I just thought about trying to create the best voice I could for a character that I mean, I knew the story of Aladdin and I knew that in different versions, the character of Jafar was either a wicked uncle or a wizard or a, I knew that he had all different incarnations and I'd seen several of those and researched some of it, but I never pinned gayness, queerness on it. I never pinned that on the character, except maybe subconsciously I thought it's so interesting to me. It's so much more interesting. I think that what appealed to me at the time as a kid and still appeals to me is this scale, the scale that they play their lives at. It's enormous. It's operatic. They always have silhouettes that are bigger than life and unusual and more attractive. Yes. Usually there's, you know, other things that go along with the silhouette, you know, color and et cetera, et cetera. And then, you know, actors bring their own mannerisms and idiosyncrasies and stuff to it. So no, I never thought one bit about it. This is a long-winded answer to say no. I just didn't think about it, except that I think it was somewhere in my brain, you know, that I was attracted to it. And I was hoping as I was working on Jafar that people would be as attracted to Jafar as they were to Captain Hook and Maleficent and Ursula and, you know, Stromboli and you name it. I just was trying to figure out the best way to create the character. And the way that you do that as an actor is you read the text, you read it over and over and over, and you get everything you can absorb from the text. And then I ask them for a drawing, a preliminary drawing. It's not the drawing that you and I know of.
Okay. I was going to ask.
No, in fact, there are about 9. I could have printed them out and shown them to you. I can do it another time. There are about 9 different versions that I saw of Jafar that were other, because before Andreas took over as, you know, everybody throws their hat in the ring.
Of course.
To try to, and they, everybody came up with these great ideas, and each and every one of them, Katie, is more different than the next. The one that a lot of them had in common, and the drawing that they sent me, I think actually John Musker had done, was that he had a long face, and he had very heavy eyelids.
Interesting.
To me, the heavy eyelids and the calm demeanor, which he was sort of, you know, looked like he had in this drawing, said opium addiction to me.
Interesting. Okay.
Because that's, if there was a substance of abuse at that time in history, that's what he would have been using.
Oh.
And it makes people very, either very calm or go crazy. So in that case, in the text, Jafar does both. You know, he can be very, very smooth, very mercurial, until he finally has like a psychotic break at the end and goes crazy. And he does himself in, which is what most villains do. That's all I was thinking about. And also I was thinking about the story and the character. And, you know, this also crosses over with, did I feel that I shouldn't be auditioning for that character, playing him, because I'm not North African Middle Eastern? And the answer to that is no. I didn't think about that. I was just thinking about what's the best way I can figure out this wicked... Oh, suddenly it's got very bright.
Yeah, I noticed that too. I didn't know what that was.
The sun is coming in. Sorry. I didn't see it.
You're glowing.
Yeah, if only. that's it. Really, that's it. That's what I intended to do, set out to do. And I guess I did it because I got the gig.
You had so many gigs after that, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But none of it was predicated on any of that stuff. But in retrospect, back to the original subject that we're talking about.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was somewhere. It wasn't conscious on my part, but it definitely is why I've always been attracted to those characters.
Mm. I remember reading Andreas had also been in a couple of like Disney textbooks talking about queer coding and how like there are certain lines that people may say that could be read as queer coded, but they weren't intentionally meant to be that way. Or I think Andreas also mentioned that he would purposely try to draw certain characters to be identified as queer, but obviously, you know, it's not ultimately just up to him. So I thought that was really interesting as well, because he didn't intend to, but in certain instances, he may have done it on purpose. But that's just one example of like bringing himself to that character, which I thought was really interesting as well.
Well, there are many ways you can do it, of course. And right. I think, well, some of those ways are things that we already talked about. I said, you know, this crazy silhouette, this, and that usually has to do with their wardrobe.
Yes.
And this is the thing and that I'm not clear about. Do you think the queer coding also is attached to other characters like the princes and princesses? I mean, do you think that there are kids who are attracted to the princes, young boys who are attracted to the princes because they're so handsome and strong, and so they, and the same thing with women, young girls are attracted to the female characters? I mean, in that way too, you think it's possible?
Definitely. I think people will often say like, you know, so-and-so is like, Princess Jasmine is like really hot. She's very sexy, right? But I don't think the conversation usually continues from that moment. It's like, Princess Jasmine is very sexy and she's very strong-minded and strong-willed, and she does, you know, has all these great strengths of a strong, independent leader, which we didn't really have at that time. She was the first, right? But that's kind of where the conversation dies. The conversation continues of, oh, I love Maleficent because she's so well-dressed and she's very petty, but we love it. And she does X, Y, and Z things. So usually the conversation continues and keeps going with the villains. I also think it's because they're not necessarily wronged, but there's like a they're hiding part of their identity, and they are essentially like banished or penalized for being themselves. And I think that's another, there's more about like the idea of failing and being your authentic self and people not liking that and people shunning you. And there's like all these, like all the negatives plus the positives when you look at a Disney villain compared to a prince or princess, I think. I was trying to think of examples, but I know I've definitely read more about villains on both sides, like both ways. And what I was going to say is with the Disney princes and princesses, there's like animators who gender bend them, so they like switch the genders. So you have like Aladdin and Jasmine, but instead it's Jasmine is Aladdin and Aladdin is Jasmine. So they switch their genders. So there are things like that, but I don't think it's been in the conversation as long as the whole idea of queer coding. Yeah.
Well, yes, because if you go, back through the 50-year or more than 50-year now pantheon of Disney animated characters, I guess you could probably identify in the villains, queer coding in the villains more easily, for one thing. It's extremely interesting. And I think I mentioned to you that there were like seven songs that were written for Jafar over a period of time. One of them was called My Time Will Come. And then there was a reprise at the end of the movie called My Time Has Come. And there are moments in the verse to that song in which Jafar, he's in his lair and kind of like smoking or drinking or whatever he's
Right, whatever,
doing
yeah.
by himself, entertaining himself. And he tries to conjure up this person who can help him, this diamond in the rough. And it's almost like so in a sense, he sees Aladdin and he thinks, ooh, that could be just the perfect person because and then whatever he thinks, he's
Right.
taste, he's vulnerable, he's, you know what I mean? I mean, and I guess I wonder now in retrospect, did they axe that song because they were like, ooh, this is a little creepy. This isn't just queer coded. This is, like stalker
Yeah, stalker targeting.
behavior. I don't know. I don't know. I don't, and the other thing is that unfortunately there are a lot of people that are no longer around anymore that you could even talk
Yeah,
to about
I
this.
know.
I mean, I wish that Howard Ashman was still
That's
around
what
because
I was gonna say too. I was like, oh, I wish Howard Ashman
he
had
was
come back.
brilliant, Katie. He was so
Yeah.
good working with people, with actors, and he was, yeah, I mean, I know that it was because of Howard that I got the role. I know that he was my champion.
Really?
Yes, I think other people liked me and thought, I was a good idea, but I think it was really Howard that championed me for a number of reasons, but and nothing to do with, being gay. It just that there was a quality that he knew that I had to bring to a Disney villain, which all Disney villains have, which is kind of, I think, I'm patting myself on the back now, a kind of deliciousness, a kind of reveling in their delicious, awful behavior, that takes the edge off of being just awful, just mean, just nasty, just another murderer.
That actually leads to the next question too. So, sympathetic villains. Because I feel like my generation grew up with you and with Pat Carroll and all of those great actors and villains characters. But I would say in the past like 10 years or so, this whole idea of like sympathetic villains has been really big for listeners. Sympathetic villains are villains who have backstories, and we as audience members are given reasons to attempt to justify their villainous actions, right? Versus like characters like Jafar and Ursula, where we don't really have any backstory. We just know they're deliciously evil and revel in it and are fine with who they are and what they are trying to accomplish, the ways in which they, take action. So I'm thinking of like the Descendants TV movies, Disney Channel movies. I'm thinking of Maleficent with Angelina Jolie. The live action Beauty and the Beast shows Gaston as having PTSD from being in the army. And so he's kind of like more murderous, so to speak. Cinderella shows Lady Tremaine as having a her backstory of losing her husband and having to remarry and then losing that husband and financially being insecure and things like that. But I was curious, when we think about villains, both sympathetic and non-sympathetic, do you, aside from Jafar, of course, do you have a personal favorite? I know you mentioned Captain Hook, you mentioned Lady Tremaine, Maleficent and others, but do you have like your one?
I honestly,
monster?
You could go down the list and I could tell you reasons why I love all of them. And they would be, and some of the reasons would be the same.
Yeah.
You know, the scale at which they play out their lives, the exotic wardrobes they have, et cetera, things we talked about. But, you know, a lot, I find them, well, you know, Stromboli in Pinocchio, he's the puppet master. He's one of the angriest, meanest, ugliest characters. And of course, then there's also the fox and the cat in that same movie, who are also technically villains, and also Lampwick, who's the kid that smokes the cigar, who, you know. So I really, you're asking me to choose which I love best.
Or another one would be like, who's the most unique to you?
Most unique?
Yeah.
God. They cover such vast time frames too.
Yes.
The most unique. Well, I think because Ursula is a sea creature.
Yes.
Opposed to a land person. Like, are there any other creatures, Disney villains, that aren't? Oh, well, there's, you know, in Jungle Book, of course.
Right, yeah. Shere Khan.
Shere Khan. That's kind of obvious, though. I mean, I do think that the Sea Witch, Ursula the Sea Witch, is unique in that way.
Yes, for sure.
In her form and...
And her alternate form as the person, as Vanessa with Ariel's
voice.
Oh,
yes, yes. I don't know. Also, you know, Jafar and Maleficent both have like talking pets.
Yeah, I heard Maleficent was kind of like the inspiration for Jafar.
Well, because Andreas is a huge fan of Mark Davies, I think, who is.
Okay.
Huge fan of, and also, well, this is like more historical stuff, and you should try to talk to other people about this. But I believe, you know, when Andreas went to work for the studio, a lot of the seven original animators, the seven old men, as they called, are still alive. And Mark Davies was one of them. And I believe that Andreas had, you know, really had a strong connection to the kind of drawing that Mark did and other people did. I know that Andreas has a picture. I have it too. He sent me a copy for Mark Davies' birthdays, for some birthday of his. He did a really wonderful drawing of Maleficent with her hand out like this, and Jafar in a deep bow taking her hand to kiss her hand.
Oh.
In a gesture of saying, sorry, it's taking me a long time to say, I want to say this right, in a gesture, in a way that Andreas could tip his hat to Mark in a gesture of saying, thank you for your inspiration.
Oh.
So he put those two characters on the page for a birth, I think it was a birthday of Mark's. So I don't know about all the other animators that, you know, did all the other characters so much. But there is a strong connection. I do have a strong connection between Maleficent and Jafar because, you know, they both have staffs. They both have funny hats. They both have birds. They, you know, there's a lot of things about them. And they both have a certain dignity and elegance that goes away very quickly as soon as the door is closed. So that's appealing to me, too. That kind of, that duplicitous behavior is very interesting to play.
Oh, I bet.
You know, Ursula has that too. You know, you'll have to look at her pretty face. I don't know. There's something about her toughness that appealed to me. And I was a big fan of hers. And also, I think I mentioned to you maybe that we were at a villains convention.
Yes.
And we had a lot of fun. I don't know. I couldn't choose. But I mean, I do think that Ursula stands out because of her form. Brilliant, because they could have made the Sea Witch, let's face it, in a gazillion different ways, but that was a brilliant idea. And also the fact that they used the John Waters performer as an inspiration for Ursula.
Oh, yes. The Divine?
Divine, yeah.
Okay.
Divine. So, you know, it doesn't get queerer than that. I mean, So that's perhaps a little more blatantly out there. I don't know. I think she stands out for me because of that, because of her form. Also, I have to say, she
Yes,
has a great song. Poor
she
Unfortunate
does.
Souls is a great song. And losing Howard Ashman when we did, we lost the opportunity. I believe that's when we really lost the opportunity for them to find a good song for Jafar, because even though Tijuana is wonderful, there was a simpatico between Alan and Howard, obviously from working together for so many years. They never really found the song. The song that they thought we had was called Why Me, which was a
Oh,
song
yes.
actually recorded
Yes, I've heard that song.
a 100 and some odd piece orchestra, and it was kind of cataclysmic and terrific. But once it was put in the movie, I think it was Jeffrey Katzenberg thought that it brought the movie to a halt. It was almost like this is the end of the world, you know. So
Oh, yeah.
they moved on and from that. So, 30 years of
Yeah.
it's really, and it's they say 30, it's really 31 for us, because we started a year before,
Yeah.
a year and 9 months I worked on the project.
Is that considered a long time for a movie?
I don't know. It's considered a long time, I think, for an animated, for a voice. And in my case, a lot of it just had to do because of
They redid it. They scrapped it, right?
which
The movie script.
of Aladdin.
Yeah.
I think all the scripts were probably scrapped at one point and redone. I mean, it's not really scrapped. It just means they go back and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. Yeah. But I think that's common, because when they bring actors onto a project at that point, first of all, you have to remember computer animation was in its infancy, really. I mean, there's a little bit of it in Aladdin, but it's used as another tool in the movie. A lot of it is still hand drawn.
Yeah.
So the amounts of time, you're talking about a time frame now, and it's changed. My understanding was that they were working on the movie. The team was working on Aladdin for 2 years, even before they bring actors in.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Because the animation, in the sense, is the last thing to be done. You know that.
Yeah.
Because it's too expensive to scrap fully animate. So that's why all the editing is done, the voicing process. So every time you go in, they could have new. A scene you've recorded 5 times, they may have yet another scene to record of the same scene, different dialogue. So that takes up time. Yeah, things changed because of computer animation, I guess.
Yeah.
But I think that's right. I think I'm remembering correctly. So all the three picture film that Howard and Alan had, they overlapped, I think, by like a year or two. And they're different teams. Some of the same people that worked on, say, Beauty and the Beast also worked on Aladdin and worked on Little Mermaid. They moved. But some of the people did not. So they had, in the beginning, they have research teams of animators that start doing research. So in the case of Aladdin, they're researching anything they can find about ancient and mythical Arabian places,
Right.
pottery, clothing, plants, food, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So that's like a 2 year process. And then I think then the animators go to work, and then they, at some point, they narrow it down to having a principal animator, and then who's the team on that character, and who's the background people, and who's the this and
Yeah. Okay.
That's what I know about the process. And I kind of wanted to make sure that I was involved, and I did get friendly with Andreas and would make sure that I got over to the animation building whenever I was working on the lot, because I wanted to see what was going on. I wanted to see
Yeah.
how, if it had changed, and if there was anything that I could do to, because these guys get a recording. They don't see who you are. So they hear,
Yeah.
I mean, Andreas, I even saw that Andreas once in an interview, and he said, "Well, when I heard this voice, meaning, Jonathan's voice, this is how I pictured it." And then he came into my room one day, and he was like this big bear of a man. He said, completely thrown by it. That's a part of the process too that's unique and very interesting. Just the vocal creation to fit an image. Did I
That's a
answer
good
that
one.
question? It seemed like it
I
was a
think so. Yeah, favorites
tricky.
are hard.
There's so many. I really love them all. I would have to say, though, that I will say this.
Yeah.
The first villain that I was really aware of as a kid was probably Captain Hook, just because of
Okay.
what born and, So I was very aware of that. And then, all of those villains from then on, like you said, Lady Tremaine and Maleficent and
Have you
Shiv.
seen the like live action redos, or not redos, but the live action versions of the Disney villains? There's so many.
So many. I know. It's like you, well, you know, there's an, I think, almost an inexhaustible audience for them.
Oh, for sure.
I mean, you know, kids are born every day, number one. So in terms of the child quotient and young adult quotient, and then depending on the, you know, an interesting fact about Aladdin is that one of the reasons that it had success on Broadway was on Broadway, the demographic for people that go to Broadway shows has always been pretty much the same, which is that women say to their husbands, for example, "Oh, there's this new show called blah, blah, blah. I'd love to go and see it. You want to go?" And their husband says, "Sure, let's go." And then the next biggest demographic are girls and young women and girls. And so when the leading character is a boy, is a man, and there are young kids who grew up with Aladdin, they discover that it became a date night for, you know, for heteronormative, I think, is that the right expression? Kids, it became a date night for them. Puffs a pot on the street, and then they go and they'd have a fantastic time because it's romantic. It's, you know, I mean,
That's nostalgic.
to me, it's nostalgic. To me, it's an action adventure piece.
Yes. Well,
But
especially Broadway version.
yes, exactly.
Adam Jacobs was running all over that. I was surprised he was jumping off like actual stage buildings. I was like, oh, this is real? I thought that we were just gonna pretend that we're jumping off buildings.
No, they're still jumping off them as we
Oh
speak.
my gosh.
Yeah, the new guy that's doing it, Michael, is fantastic too. The new Aladdin. I mean, Telly Liang was did our show for a while,
Oh yes,
and he
with
was
Ariel.
with Ariel, right? Because Ariel stayed longer than Adam. You know, we've always had great people, and the guy that's doing it now is sort of against type. He's very tall
Oh
and
yes.
very thin, very skinny, and he's all like arms and legs. He's kind of goony, and it's great. It kind of makes sense that this kid has the chutzpah to talk like he does and be so insolent with people like Jafar. And I don't know. It's been a pleasure. It was all a pleasure. I love them all.
It'll continue forever, probably.
I wonder. I don't know. I have my doubts.
Oh, really?
I don't know. I'm not sure it's going to be have legs like Lion King. I hope it does, but I don't know. Well, we'll see. I think that Disney prefers to only have a couple things running in on Broadway at the same time.
Oh, they have a lot right now.
Yeah. It's like on those cooking shows, you know, you're all wonderful, but someone has to go home.
Yeah.
You know.
We'll have to see how it pans out. So I watched a lot of interviews, and when we had previously met, I don't know if you know this, but they have a whole playlist of Aladdin videos that they play while you're waiting to talk to them. So when I was waiting to talk to you, they had this whole string of like clips from the movie and interviews that you previously did on like Good Morning America and whatnot and things like that. And I noticed in all your interviews and when we had talked, you had said Jafar should have been the title of the movie, right? Of Aladdin. And you actually got a sequel with Jafar's name in it, The Return of Jafar, which from my knowledge and from my research, that's the first movie with a Disney villain in the title of it.
Yes.
The only one I know of after that is like Maleficent with Angelina Jolie, which is like years later.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the other nice thing was, Jafar didn't die at the end of the movie Aladdin, so that's why he got to come back. And even when he did, event spoiler, eventually die, he still came back in the Arabian Nights Hercules TV episode, and I think something else. The video game, the Mizira video, some revenge thing. I'm curious, how would you have wanted the Return of Jafar movie to end?
Well, first of all, when I said the movie should really be called Jafar, I wasn't really serious. I was joking. I think I was trying to make a point, which is that when you're creating a character, especially a character like Jafar, when I read the script, I don't look at it from the angle that the script has been written. I don't I'm trying to tell my story, or the story that's been written, the best I can. And so if you asked me, I think this is what I said at the time, I would have said, if you asked me what the movie is about, what Aladdin is about, I would have said, it's about a grand vizier in a mythical kingdom whose name is Jafar, who basically wants to take over the world and doesn't, and nothing is going to get in his way.
Fair.
And to that end, I would say, that's how you focus a character. You tell your story. Aladdin became secondary to me when I was working with him. And secondary, when I say that, I mean, not intellectually, but emotionally and physically, if I was to
physically. Taking up space.
He's over there.
Yeah.
Let me just tell you what I want to do. This is what I think should happen. Yeah. So it was sort of a joke when I said that, but I think I was using it as a way to illustrate how I maybe approach the character, which is basically the way actors, I think, approach most characters. You know, I don't think that's so weird.
No, I think it's great. It shows like how into the character you are.
Well, I mean, it paid off.
Oh yeah.
It accomplished what I hoped it would do, which was that he would become a strong enough character that he would become one of the great iconic Disney villains.
He's one of the Disney villain pillars.
Yeah. So, you know, he moves usually, you know, between, he never quite gets the first place. I noticed that usually Maleficent has that tied up. And
yes, the mistress of all evil.
Yeah.
Kind of a hard label to beat.
Well, it is. But also she has that great moment, you know, and now this is interesting. She doesn't have a great song at all, but she has a great moment. Right. When she transforms herself into the dragon and she says, with all the
powers of hell,
hell, something like that. And so I think it's the only time that the word hell is.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah.
So that's very powerful. So she didn't get a song, but she got the H word.
Yes. The H word in a really great, like dramatic scale up, glow up, so to speak.
I had so much fun with Pat Carroll again. I just have to say that it made me wish that all of the people that had played Disney villains, voiced Disney villains, I wish there was a way to get all of them in a room and have a conversation, a forum. I mean, this is
a round table.
About what you're doing, Katie, is that you're, whether or not what I'm saying is important or not, you're at least preserving some what the person actually thinks. Hans Conried, who's the voice of Captain Hook, is someone who I admired as a kid and knew him from television shows. You know, he played this character named Uncle Tanoose on the Danny Thomas show, who was like an uncle from, I can't remember what country he was supposed to be from, Syria or something. Eleanor Audley, who's the voice of Maleficent, was on I Love Lucy shows.
Oh.
You can Google her probably and find her. She's always like this woman who's the head of like some women's society or something. She's, you know, some snappy, snarly, knows better than everybody. She's typecast as that, and she's always like beautifully dressed, and she's always very pulled up and together and kind of snide. Anyway, so when I was growing up, television was, you know, in its infancy, but was blossoming really in the 50s and the 60s, and I saw all these people that voice. So I would see the Danny Thomas series and I would think, that voice. And, you know, finally years later, I sewed it all together and I figured out, well, these are just actors. These are just actors who
just
took the bet. Well, I mean, in the sense that they weren't celebrities.
Mm.
It wasn't Angelina Jolie, because characters like Jafar, Iago, Maleficent, you know, those are character roles.
Mm-hmm.
That's another thing, you know, that comes from the theater, old timey theater, is that, you know, there's an ingenue, there's a juvenile, there's supporting characters. And amongst the supporting characters, there's like, you know, parents and sisters and brothers and talking pets and so on. But the villains are sort of like third banana. There's a leading man, a leading lady, or a leading lady, a leading man. In the case of Aladdin, there's a leading lady and a leading man. There's also the genie, who's kind of like really the focus of the story.
Yeah.
And then the next character down the line is the villain. So in vaudeville, they call that the second banana or the third banana. And in a sense, it's the most important character, because without a villain, you don't have a good story.
Right.
The story and the the nice people need something to push against.
Yes.
Because if there's nothing to push against, what is it? It's a poem. It's not, you know, it's not a story.
Yeah.
Anyway, so that it becomes very, you know, it's tricky because villains are, in a sense, villains are the leading character because they create, so that this is back to what we were talking about.
Yes.
We create the problem that has to be solved, and that is the story. That is what we know of Aladdin and Sleeping Beauty and so on and so forth. Otherwise, what would Sleeping Beauty be without Maleficent? It'd be a very happy, pretty, boring kingdom.
Yeah, and she wouldn't know anything about the outside world. She would just go to the castle.
And the conceit that she's pissed off because there weren't enough golden plates, because that's the story they fed her. Well, that is pretty lame.
It's very,
that's why she wasn't invited.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's the original story.
The original? Okay.
They had to make it just because they had only a certain number of golden plates. Now, whether that was true, that they had just enough golden plates to invite the people they needed to invite, were important to invite, dignitaries from other kingdoms, whatever,
right.
And, you know, the good fairies, Florifawn and Merryweather,
yeah,
clap them all. you know, whether that's true or they just said, we'll just tell her there weren't enough golden plates.
Right.
It's also kind of mean and snotty.
Yeah.
So wait, what was the beginning of the question, though? I feel like
so the question was, what would have been Jafar's happily ever after?
Oh, happily ever after, right. Well, his ultimate happily ever after would have been to win, to take over Agrabah, and then the next step would have been the world. I mean, that pretty much is, that would have happened with Ursula, too. You know, she just wanted to take over the sea, and after the sea, then the land, you know, and after the land, then... But for me,
then would he have ended up not being happy because he would have everything, but he would still want more, right?
Oh yeah, eventually greed would. That is really true of most villains. I think it's their avarice that kills them. Their greed.
Okay.
No, Jafar never would have been happy. He was an unhappy person.
Yeah.
He was always looking for
something more.
Something more.
So based on Jafar, what for you has been the most challenging part of playing Jafar? It's because when I watch you, it just seems so effortless. Like you are Jafar. But
I mean, on Broadway. Been,
on Broadway and in the movie, right? Were there any challenges in portraying Jafar?
Yes. Well, first of all, getting the part, I mean, you know, I had to do I did a lot of work, you know, a lot of preparation for my audition. And, you know, the auditions are very quick. Did we talk about this at all?
I don't think so. I'm not familiar.
You know, I went into a room that was probably a half the size of the room that I'm in now, which means a small room, with my accompanist, my piano player, and
you had to sing, too.
Yeah, to sing. For the audition, yeah. So my accompanist and the casting director, the wonderful Albert Tavares, died of AIDS. And in the original film, he has a plate at the end saying, you know, it's dedicated, you know, to the memory of, first of all, Howard Ashman. And then also there's another place, Albert Tavares. Anyway, I had done an off-Broadway musical with Nathan Lane and Reggie Cafe and wonderful people that was, I don't want to say it was a disaster, but let's say it was problematic and it was it was so challenging, but that's another whole story. And Albert Tavares cast it. It was directed and choreographed by Graziella Danielle, fabulous woman. And the music, the score of the piece was called In a Pig's Valise. And the score of the piece was written by Kid Creole and the Coconuts, who were a very popular group in the late 60s and the 70s. The show itself was very problematic, but it was cast by Albert Tavares, and in it I was playing a character named Zut Alors, who is an imposter, and in the second act he appears as Mr. Gutbucket, who is the villain of the piece, and it was the first time that anyone allowed me to actually play a villain on stage.
Interesting.
Growing up in the business, I played a lot of juveniles because I always looked younger than I was for a very long time. I moved to the city when I was only, I guess, 22, and I still looked like I was in my late teens at the time. And, you know, I was pretty together, and I was, you know, it was important to me to stay fit, and so I could so I could get roles.
Yeah.
But they were never the roles I wanted. They were always crappy young leading men that were stupid. And the parts that I wanted, not the stupid head parts, were the parts that I grew up doing in children's theater, which were characters like Jafar, you know, and sidekicks and crazy kings and, you know, somebody's dumb uncle.
Characters with range.
Yes. Yes. And costumes, nicer costumes.
Yes. Elegant costumes.
There we are. Yes. Finer fabrics. So 2 years later, I guess, maybe.
Yeah.
I get this call from my agent because I had made a big fuss about not being seen for Little Mermaid or for Beauty and the Beast. And I had an agent at the time who I still am in touch with and love, named Diana Rolnick. I'm going to give her a shout out in case she ever hears this. Mm-hmm. Also very interested in animation. And I said, when I finally was in exasperation, I went into her office and I said, Diana, just get me an audition for Aladdin. I don't care what you have to do. That's all I want. I just want the audition. You have to get me the part. I can get the part. I'll get the part. You get the, you know. And Jafar was a character that as soon as I read it, I knew exactly what to do with it. I had to do a lot of work to make it better, but better for myself. But I knew what the character was. I got it instantly. I could hear the voice that was written. And I just knew that it was like a part for me. It's just one of those things. And Albert called me in to audition for it. So you go into this little room and there's a tape recorder, a reel-to-reel tape recorder. This is before technology. There's no, and my piano player. I sing a song. And then I had to read a couple of scenes. And they had sent me a preliminary drawing. And that was all I had. That's what I went into the room. Wow. And that was it. Just the three of us in that room. Months went by before I got a call saying that I had a call back.
Wow.
And callback was a whole other deal because it was Disneyfied, as I like to say. It was a very grand studio, quite large, and the room had been draped with heavy curtains for sound. They put a platform at one end of the room where the piano was and a microphone. At the other end of the room, there were like 12 guys in suits.
Oh, God.
Women, mostly scary looking men in suits. And nobody really introduced themselves. I knew who Albert Tavares was because I'd met him and he was sitting there. And they said to me, Jonathan, please do the same audition that you did last time. We liked it. Just please do the same thing. And so I stepped up to the mic and they said, whenever you're ready, sing your song first and then we'll do the scenes. I did my song, which is some crazy old song called Play Gypsies, Dance Gypsies. I think that's what I sang. And then they said, okay, let's do the scenes. And I did this and Albert read with me, I think. And he was down there and I was up at this, you know. And as soon as I started to sing, I saw all the men and women who were sitting at the other end of the room close, you know, put their head in their hands like this. So for the first minute of my audition, I was processing, oh no, I've done something terribly wrong. They hate me. They don't even want to look at me. That, you know. And then quickly, they're just listening.
Yeah.
Seeing me wasn't, you know, I was used to auditioning for roles in plays and musicals and film and TV. And I did a lot of television commercials at the time. There's a ton of television commercials with me. And I'm playing like young fathers and Goonie dates. And I don't know, products, you know,
yeah.
when there were a lot of commercials. Anyway, that's what I had been doing. So except for In a Pig's Valise and this, it was like a really big opportunity for me to like make the jump into where I wanted to be, at least where I thought I should be. And I was right. Mm-hmm. What was the original question that maybe got on?
What has been the most challenging part about playing Jafar?
Oh, so the challenging part was, first of all, getting it, not playing it. And the amount of, you know, I did a bunch of research. There was no script. They wouldn't send the script. They would only send me the scene. So I had to really delve into this couple of pages of dialogue and see what I could, you know, weed out to use. Yeah. There are several steps to what's the most challenging part. The first challenging part is getting yourself mentally in the right space so that you don't blow up, because, you know, you have to tell yourself, look, this is your part. Fuck everything else. Don't
listen.
Like one of my doctors always says, don't believe everything you think. So you have to get all those negative voices out of your head and then do the audition and get through that and then go through a callback and then another 3 months of waiting. Getting the film was hard just because the process was extended, drawn out. And then I booked it right before Christmas in 1990. Yeah. Christmas 1990, because in January of 91, they rushed me into the studio to demo a song called Humiliate the Boy, which is, you can find that online. That was the song, the last song that Howard Ashman wrote. And he was in the hospital and I was in a studio and they were holding the phone up so he could, because there was no technology. Alan was literally holding the phone up and then Howard would give notes to me and of what we should do. And then we'd do it again. And then, anyway, so it was a rush to get into the studio. So that was all challenging, you know. And then I mostly worked in LA in Studio B at the corner of Dopey Drive and Goofy Lane. And I had to literally get on an airplane and go to LA. And sometimes I'd just be there for a few hours. And sometimes I'd get on an airplane and go and I'd be there for, you know, 4 days or 5 days because they had a lot to do. But just the challenge of that and then being vocally prepared when we got to the hard stuff, the screaming, the psychotic episodes, the laughing, all that stuff. That was the hardest part of making the movie. It was just technical. The rest of it was a dream. It was not hard at all. It was like, I knew what to do with, I felt that I really knew what to do with the character. And I felt that because I knew what to do, that was the thing that Howard had responded to. And I feel that I feel that Howard was the one that said to them, you know, we only have two auditions from him, but this is what you should be going for. Now, mind you, the contract that I got in the beginning only guaranteed me about 4 days in the studio, that they could cut me loose if it didn't work out.
That's so awful.
It's awful, but it worked out. Always have that hanging over you too. So those were the challenges. The challenges for me were not to do with the character of Jafar and creating the character. They're all extraneous things. Things that had to do with just the technical thing of getting there and having enough vocal energy to give them what they wanted.
So follow-up question then, because oftentimes if we watch bloopers or whatnot, you'll see someone like doing the scene over and over. So then when you're doing things like the cackle or you're doing the screaming, I'm assuming you're doing that over and over again.
Yes.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And like in the fighting scenes and stuff, they'd be like, okay, we need sound. We need noise like, ooh, ah, you know, grr, you know, all that crap, which is nothing. But like the laugh thing, they'd be like, okay, we need a 5 second laugh. We need a 10 second laugh.
Oh.
So they watch the clock. We need an 8 second laugh. Uh-huh. Okay, give us the longest laugh you can possibly give and let it fade out, you know, for like the end of that, the reprise of Prince Ali that goes into heat, you know.
The rings around his eyes and
yeah,
he just keeps going, yeah.
You know, and some days they'd be like, ugh, we had a technical problem. Can we do that again?
Oh my God.
Be like, yeah, sure. You know, you never said no. And they were all so lovely. I mean, to work for. I mean, Ron and John were the nicest directors. They were the writers and producers and also directing. So one of them was in the studio and one of them. And then, you know, redoing things. You know, the genie wasn't always blue. He was all these different colors. So every time they changed the genie's color, I'd have to go in and redo all the lines that had, you know, instead of the big blue lout, I think was the line.
Yeah.
He'd be like, he's no longer green, John. We have to, the hardest thing is always the technical stuff. Recording, just having to do take after take of, you know.
Oh, I can never imagine that.
Because in the beginning you get to do some of your scenes with people who are in your scenes with you.
That's right, yes.
And then as time goes on and, you know, everyone has a lot of other things to do, you end up just standing at a microphone in the studio with someone who reads lines to you, reads your cues to you.
Yeah.
And then when it gets down to the nitty gritty at the end, when they just need to change this or that quickly, then you just stand there at the microphone by yourself and you just go line to line to line. And you just do it 10 times each, 10 times each, 10 times each.
Oh my gosh.
Or three or whatever they ask for.
Yeah.
And when you're working with people you really admire and respect and end up having an affection for, you just never say no. Actors are so stupid in that way. They never say no. You know, I miss a lot of people now already.
Yeah. Fond memories.
Linda and I are going to a big Comic-Con November 4th, 5th, and 6th in Providence.
Oh, that's soon. It's really soon.
And we're traveling together. And, that's, you know, and this Good Morning America thing, they called me and said, you know, they'd like you to come to this interview. Would you do it? And I said, well, of course I will. And I said, who else is coming? Are you, at least, you know, is Linda, because she lives in New York. She's in Florida. And Scott lives in California. So it's getting kind of lonely.
Yeah. It's like reunions are so fun.
It just changes everything. Yeah. Perspective, I think, is also, you know, we're having this big conversation. If we'd had this conversation 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I mean, even when first opened, it would have been probably very different. Mm-hmm. I would remember different things, you know. I remember being in the first time we recorded with everybody. We did some scene with Linda, Scott, Robin, Gilbert, and me. Just, you know, that it's good of them to do that because you get to hear other voices. You get to hear what the other voices, at least you can hold them in your part of it in your head when you're about them. Gilbert, I did the most with because he was always on my shoulder. Those are the things, I don't know.
It's a different time then because people nowadays don't really record all together, at least it seems.
No, it's all digital. I think I told you I worked on this new online, it's called Hell of a Boss.
Yes.
And you just go into a studio and they're out there and you're here. And we did a little bit of that with once, you know, as the years went on with Aladdin stuff, but not in the beginning.
Mm. The Hercules episode that you all did, was that like a reunion or was that kind of on your own?
Oh, no, that was, I never met James Woods. Is that what you mean?
No, like with Scott and I'm trying to think of what the scene was. It would have been probably with Scott, the battle scene with Hercules fighting Jafar and then Aladdin fighting Hades.
I don't even remember. That's terrible. There are a lot of things I don't remember, I have to say, at this point. I thought you meant the scene with Hades.
That scene is like the highlight.
Yeah, I was just in the studio alone for that.
I thought the banter was great, though. It was like you were together.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, he's a terrific actor. You keep hoping you'll meet these people sometime.
There really needs to be, like, some kind of other, like, Disney Con where everybody, I feel like that would be so great.
It would be interesting.
We got that scene in Wreck-It Ralph where all the princesses were together.
I know.
Like, why can't we do the same thing for the villains?
Princesses have a lot more cachet, and the princess thing is very strong. The sisterhood is strong. I mean, Linda has quite a lot of people that want to see her and meet her. And I mean, I do too, but it's obvious that the, you know, like I said, the princess thing, whatever the princess thing is very strong. It's very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm a little bit envious of it in a way.
You know, funny enough, I don't think I said this before, but I think it's so hilarious because I always thought that, you know, kids at a very young age would see Jafar and they would be like scared or, you know, a little taken aback by his appearance and his cackle and whatnot. But my son loves the intro scene, Jafar's first scene.
Oh, yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
You're late.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
That's a good scene.
Yeah, he loves that scene, and he loves the following Cave of Wonders scene, where he like sends him in, and then he like essentially gets eaten by the Cave of Wonders.
Yeah, those are great. That's the first scene that I saw animated.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in pencil test, not full animation, but they showed that to me. They said, we have something to show you today. We think you're going to like it. And they had taken that scene with Iago and the thief. Gazim, is that what's his name? Gazim?
Yes.
So there was a pencil test animation of just starting with the Jafar arriving on the horseback in the desert and then saying to him, you're late. And I remember that. Talk about remembering first times. I mean, I remember hearing my voice coming out of that character for the first time. And it thrilled me. I have to admit, I like filled with a little more pride that day. I was so excited. I mean, they were right to show it to me because they knew that it would.
It's really real now.
Yes.
It was real, but now it's like real, real.
Yeah. Now it's happening. Now they'll probably not fire me.
Yeah. Can't now.
Oh gosh. You know, when Jafar gets in disguise as the prisoner, so ridiculous with Jafar as the hump. I mean, brilliant, just a brilliant character. So figuring that out, you know, in the studio when I was recording it, they gave me some rag to put on and they gave me like a stick to hold. And so I could, because if you physicalize it, you can sometimes find more, you can get a better voice out, you know. If you make a problem for yourself, then it means you have to be very specific when you're playing that moment. With acting, you go moment to moment. Really, that's how it works. You go moment to moment.
These are all things that like I never would have known. I didn't ask you myself.
Well, that's how life is. You know, there was a wonderful actor, character actor that I worked with years ago named Jimmy Coco. He was a very big star for a long time. He did a lot of film and TV, and I can't remember what the context was now, but I was struggling to say something or ask him something, and he said something to me like, well, what, just spit it out, what is it you got? He said, you got to tell people what you want. You have to tell people what you want. You can't expect them to read your mind. And I thought that's true, but sometimes it's hard to ask for things, and you know, that takes a long time too. That's like living a fear-based life. You have to live, you have to get a little brave, and you know, the worst that can happen is they can say no.
Totally.
You're probably not going to like point their finger at you and you're going to disappear into a pile of ashes. That's not going to
That's
happen.
true. Yeah. Hopefully. Yes.
Yeah.
Are you open to saying some popular Disney villain quotes as Jafar?
Oh, sure. Oh, yes. Oh, I should have printed it out for that.
Do you want me to share? I can share my screen.
Did we cover the queer coding thing enough? I can't tell. It's like,
That's up to you and how much you want to talk about it.
oh no, I mean, did I answer all the questions you had about it, or?
Yes, you answered all my questions.
Okay, now this is good. Okay, let's start at the top.
Okay.
Yes, Evil Queen. I like that one, Mirror, Mirror on the Wall. Because I always felt that Jafar had a certain amount of vanity, which is maybe that's another thing about queer coding. Maybe vanity has a lot to do with it. I don't know. Do you know what I
Maybe.
mean?
Not specifically about vanity. I know people would always talk about like being well dressed and kind of walking through with a kind of grace and elegance, and male villain characters having like body language or performance that would stereotypically be female or feminine. Like Governor Ratcliffe in his song where he's like singing with a bunch of sweaty men around him and he's in pink and purple and like those kind of views, I guess, like that aesthetic. But I haven't heard about vanity.
Well, for example, you know, there's a scene when Jafar like is sitting on the Sultan's throne. He kind of sinks into it, and he kind of drapes himself over it, and he wants to know what it feels like, you know. He's trying to get it into his body. And but there's that moment where I feel like Jafar is not just feeling what it's like, but he's also picturing himself. That's the kind of vanity I mean. That's kind of like, you know, you're so vain. I bet you think the song is about you, that Carly Simon song. Okay, so here we go. Mirror, mirror on the wall, who is the fairest one of all?
Do Cruella de Vil. How are you?
Miserable, darling, as usual, perfectly wretched.
I like that one.
That's a good one. I killed Mufasa. That probably just sounded like Jeremy Irons. That's a good one, Jeremy Irons. I mean, a scar. I mean, that's.
Oh yeah.
Let's see. Oh, great one. Don't underestimate the importance of body language. I think that's. Boy, there's vanity in that too. I don't know.
Yes.
Oh, Maleficent, I have to do it. You poor simple fools, thinking you could defeat me. Me, the mistress of all evil. She can do it better. See, that's another thing. This is interesting. This is an interesting exercise. But the language is very specific.
Mm-hmm.
Those characters.
Yes.
I mean, people are always saying to me, what was your favorite line as Jafar? Was your, and, you know, I usually say most of them, you know, my most abject and humble apologies, Your Majesty. You know, there are several that come to mind, but I think about it and the language is so specifically written for that character and they're all sort of deliciously disgusting. he's deliciously duplicitous. He's, you know, let's see. Good form, Mr. Smee. Blast good form. Did Pan show good form when he did this to me? How was that?
That was good. I loved it.
Hey everyone, it's me, Katie, again. I hope you like this episode as much as I love recording and editing it. Stay tuned for the next episode. Jonathan will be talking about Aladdin on Broadway and playing Jafar live on stage. There's lots of tips for aspiring Broadway and theater performers sprinkled throughout the episode, so you will not want to miss it. You can find the podcast on Instagram at www.ofdisvillains or on the website www.wonderfulworldofdisneyvillains.com. I'll include links to both in the description in case you are interested. And of course, you can find me, Katie, on Instagram at DISVillainsScholar. Have a happy and safe Halloween, everyone!